It's one of the sayings of our time. There's an app for that. The explosion of cell phones and other mobile devices came with an explosion of apps or applications. We call them programs on bigger computers. Today's guest certainly notices the explosion of mobiles and apps and says those are not the things that will make us happy. He could not be clearer. The title of Max Strom's most recent book is There Is No App for Happiness, How to Avoid a Near-Life Experience. Max Strom is a yoga instructor and philosopher and writer and screenwriter and all-around deep thinker. And he's our guest once again on the Jefferson Exchange. Max, thanks for joining us.
Hey, good morning. It's good to be back with you, Jeff.
Tell us, if you would, Max, about the career path you have followed. How did you get to where you are now?
A very odd path indeed. I started out, I'll give you the 30-second version. I started out really on fire about the larger questions of life at a very early age, at around 15. So my whole late teens, early 20s was studying comparative religions, philosophies, and practicing meditation and Qigong and so on. But I hit a wall at some point and started following more of an artistic pursuit. So I was a singer-songwriter through most of my 20s and a screenwriter through my early 30s. And when I got reintroduced to Hatha Yoga in Los Angeles, I started practicing really regularly, and it really pulled everything together for me because I realized that that was the missing link in my previous studies, that the body has to be included in your developmental path, because when you change your body through these practices, it heals you emotionally. It changes how you respond to other people and all of your relationships, and that is key.
You were here a couple of years ago to talk about your earlier book. What prompted the writing of this one, There Is No App for Happiness?
Well, you know, I teach breathing workshops around the world to help people on an emotional basis. And through meeting many doctors of all sorts and other healthcare providers, I started learning the statistics, the skyrocketing statistics on emotionally based medication, antidepressants, anti-anxiety drugs, and sleep medications primarily. And I was just stunned to learn that we're basically with sleep medication at an epidemic level now. The CDC, November 2012, declared sleep disorder is now an epidemic in the United States. And in terms of antidepressants and anti-anxiety drugs, we now have one out of four women in the United States taking one or the other or both, with men not far behind. And this I realized at the same time I was learning about the explosion of information technology, the exponential explosion, and not only noticing all the changes in our society that you just mentioned, but the things that are forecast to be coming down the road in the next 10 to 20 years, including massive life extension. So I was thinking, this is amazing. You know, we have this information explosion, which is really serving us on many levels and could even solve our energy crisis, which is great. And we can communicate with people more than we ever have. But at the same time, people, according to our medication, are becoming less happy quickly. There's a plummeting of happiness in this country, and especially a feeling of isolation, which is ironic since we're so connected. So that's what started me really thinking about this about 3.5 years ago.
You begin the book by discussing the concept of a near-life experience. What is a near-life experience?
Yeah, it's obviously my play on words of a near-death experience, which I have had in the past. And a near-life experience. I've worked with people on their deathbed in my earlier in my life. And people who have lived a long time and are close to dying rarely regret things that they have done. Mostly everybody regrets things they didn't do, opportunities they missed, time wasted. I should have said I love her when I had the chance. I should have said I forgive you while I had the chance, or asked for forgiveness. These are the things that haunt people as they're about to leave this world. To me, that's a near-life experience where I could have had a great life. I had a good life, but I could have had a great life. But because I squandered my time, because I lived like I was physically immortal, I missed it.
You've laid out already the one of the two trends that you lay out in the beginning of the book, the big one being that we're becoming less happy, it seems, over time. But the other one is that technology is booming. And I can assume from the title of the book, then, that there you find at least a little interrelation between those two.
I certainly do, and particularly the way we use social media. And just to be clear to our audience, I'm not a Luddite. I'm not anti-technology. I love my GPS, and I use a lot of electronic devices to write my book, including voice dictation. I think it's fantastic. But in terms of social interaction, I think we're overusing technology, and this is one of the roots of the problem. A really important statistic for us all to learn or remember is that 90% of human interaction is nonverbal. 90% is nonverbal. So if we're relying on text, through whatever form, whatever appliance we use, we have a 10% relationship going on. That's all. And it leaves out tone of voice, facial expression, body posture, all the things that determine whether we trust someone or not.
Interesting. Okay, 90% nonverbal. We'll pick that up on the other side of a break. Our guest is Max Strom. His book is There Is No App for Happiness: How to Avoid a Near-Life Experience. We'll talk more with Max and take your phone calls and emails when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. It is laryngitis. Please pardon the voice. Our guest today is Max Strom. He is a yoga instructor, philosopher, writer, singer, songwriter. You name it, he's probably done it. Max Strom has written another book called There Is No App for Happiness: How to Avoid a Near-Life Experience. And you can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about this. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, and by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Max, you were just talking about how social media and texting don't offer all the things we need in conversations because 90% of conversation is nonverbal. But, I mean, we used to write letters to each other. Did we lack a lot there, or is it also the brevity of the communication?
Well, that's interesting that you bring that up. The letter writing is becoming a lost art quickly. Of course, letter writing is also text-based, but because it took so much effort to write a letter, I think that we were very selective about our wording, and there was even an art in conveying emotion, so there were at least attempts to use our vocabulary to describe our inner state. Many letters from notable people in history are kept today because they were practically poetry, or were poetry in a sense. Now we just put on an emoticon, a smiley face or something like that, to give a brief, rough sense of what we're trying to communicate. But virtual friends are not the same as actual ones. And 300 Facebook friends are not the same as 5 true friends. And I think we're losing sight of that, especially the people in under 40.
Max, you choose to define happiness in the book, and how do you define happiness?
I define happiness as the daily experience of a meaningful life. I think that as we age, we start to learn that happiness is not based on external circumstances, not real happiness. Pleasure certainly is. If we describe the perfect vacation, it's mostly external circumstances, location, comfort, weather, etc. But people will quickly choose uncomfortable circumstances if it brings them meaning. Even some professions, like let's use an example of a nurse who works in emergency care. Emergency room is a rough place to work. It's certainly not pleasurable, and a lot of nurses choose this. They volunteer for it. They'll stay in it for years because it gives them meaning. They know when they lay their head down on the bed at night, they've helped other people. They've done work for humanity, not only themselves. People will follow a cause or a candidate and sacrifice their time, their energy, their life force for something they believe in. And I think ultimately this is a much deeper source of happiness than, wasn't the Super Bowl great?
Right.
You know, there's nothing wrong with the Super Bowl. I'm not saying people should.
If you're a Denver fan,
themselves. I'm not saying we should never entertain ourselves and that you should stop playing video games immediately. But we do have to think about portion control, just like food. I don't think anybody's going to be on their deathbed saying, if only I had played more video games or if only I had watched more reality TV.
The way you describe this, though, Max, I mean, happiness sounds more like what other people might, the term that people might use for what you're describing might be more like fulfillment or satisfaction.
Yes, fulfillment. Yeah, that's a good synonymous term, fulfillment.
And so, in other words, life is going to be a little more of a steady state, perhaps. I mean, consistently good, perhaps, but not like a Pepsi commercial where everybody just looks outrageously happy.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yes, the people we admire the most in the world are people who serve humanity and maybe even inspire us to become better human beings and inspire our spiritual nature to think beyond our own pleasure, to think beyond our own comfort and entertainment.
Let us take a call. We have Bill in Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Max Strom, the author of There Is No App for Happiness.
Yeah, thank you. I have a question regarding some information. I read a book 30-some years ago called From Beyond and Back, and it was where psychologists researched death and people that came back from great, you know, never died and went through the tunnel and came back or whatever. And they all, the one thing that 90% of them, or the highest amount, said they regretted in their life, about their life the most, is that they did not see as much of the planet as they could and learn as much about the natural sciences as they could. And this was taking in all realms, as far as religion or guilt about against what you did to your parents or whatever. And I just wonder if you've heard that same thing, and what are the things that people have regretted the most that you found out?
All right. Thanks for that, Bill.
Yeah, thank you, Bill. That's a great question. I think what you just described, again, was the missed opportunities, regardless of the topic, rather than regretting what they had done. And yes, travel is one thing, or interfacing with the earth. People have different types of regrets. But a really good resource for this, actually, is a book that came out a couple of years ago called The Five Regrets of the Dying. And this is from a hospice care worker who worked with thousands of people who passed away. And the chief regrets were squandering. Basically squandering our life, our opportunities, missing our chances with the relationships that were the most meaningful to us. And people even said, I work too much. You know, I made tons of money, but instead of working all those hours, I wish I had spent more time with my family. You know, simple things like that.
One of the ones we often hear, nobody says on their deathbed, I wish I had spent more time at the office.
Exactly.
You quote Viktor Frankl in your book about a way to live life. First of all, who's Viktor Frankl, and what is it that he gave us on this subject?
Viktor Frankl is one of my heroes. I find him constantly inspirational. He wrote a book called Man's Search for Meaning, which I think was published in 1946. He was a philosopher, psychiatrist, and doctor who was Jewish and in Austria before World War II. He and his family, I think a total of 9 of them, went into the camps, the concentration camps, and only he and one of his relatives survived. And he wrote his reflections on using this scenario, this horrible scenario, as studying human beings. And it's an unusual book in that it's not a victim-aggressor type focus. It's more of how do we respond when everything is taken away from us? What makes us a human being? And he said, I break people down now into only 2 groups, decent people and indecent people. But I'm paraphrasing now. His essential message was, everything can be taken away from you. You know, all comfort, all joy, all pleasure, even the basic necessities like food, water, even the chance even knowing that you're probably not going to live till tomorrow, everybody that you love, everything can be taken away except one thing. And what makes us human, according to Viktor Frankl, is how we respond to our circumstances is our choice to the end.
So you don't have to respond negatively when you're hit with negative circumstances, in other words.
That's right. And I think that's the key to all spiritual practices or personal development practices, is ceasing to be a reactor and becoming an actor in life. Rather than constantly reacting to everything, you choose your way, you choose your course, you choose your behavior.
How different are you, Max, from say, the singer-songwriter Max of your 20s? I mean, are you a much calmer person than you think you were at that time and reacting very differently in circumstances?
Absolutely. Essentially, my nature is the same, but my position in life is completely different, because although I was in an artistic genre, which I loved, I mean, I loved writing music and orchestrating music, and I still write music sometimes as part of me, I was still living in the way that so many of us live, of what do I have to do to make you like me? What do I have to do to become successful? In other words, how do I have to change to suit you, to be noticed, to be loved? And going through my process of my practices of yoga, etc., in my 30s, I found happiness regardless of how other people saw me. I found happiness regardless of my financial worth or fame or anything else. I found happiness.
Max Drama is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the author of the book, There Is No App for Happiness, How to Avoid a Near-Life Experience. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the ways in which we make ourselves happy or make ourselves unhappy, for that matter. Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So back to the discussion, though, about trying to find happiness through apps, through mobile devices, through whatever you happen to hold in your hand that's electronic. Why do you call this the New Cambrian Explosion?
Well, I was listening to a lecture about the Cambrian Explosion, and it's a really interesting point in our Earth's history, and I'm not by any means an expert on this subject, but evidently the Earth was evolving very slowly in terms of life forms. You know, basically it was a bunch of single cell life forms on this Earth. And suddenly there was the Cambrian period, where all of a sudden everything started changing. All the major type of life forms that we are aware of now all came into being in a relatively short period of time, meaning just, you know, a few million years instead of several billion years. And it's still unexplainable. Scientists don't know why that happened. People have religious speculations, there are spiritual speculations, etc. But we don't know ultimately why that happened. But everything changed, and it changed quickly. So now the futurists of the world, like Ray Kurzweil, Peter Diamandis, etc., are saying that they don't call it the New Cambrian Explosion, but that's essentially where we are now, that everything is getting changing faster. So not only are things speeding up, but they're going to speed up exponentially. And something like in the next 100 years, we're going to have the same amount of change as we have had in the last 20,000 years.
Which pretty much accounts for what we did in the 20th century already, doesn't it?
That's right. And but the next 100 years, the 20th century is going to look like a snail's pace.
Wow.
Yeah. For example, maybe you saw the cover of Time magazine a few months ago that showed a baby on the cover, and it said this child will live to be 150 years old. In the biotech world, the new booming business is longevity, and it is being estimated now that our babies, the little ones right now and toddlers, could live to be 150 years old. That's going to change everything economically, etc.
Again, the book is called There Is No App for Happiness. You're quite clear about your feelings about social media. You call it the new white sugar of our time, which begs the question, though. I mean, we could actually be using these for slightly more worthwhile pursuits, perhaps? I mean, you think about it, if you've got a mobile device with internet access, you've got an entire library at your fingertips, and yet we watch videos of cats chasing laser pointers.
That's exactly right. I call it the new white sugar of our time because we crave it. What we crave white sugar, the more we eat it, the worse we feel. And then we go back for more. And social media is a little bit like that. There have been studies done now that show that after people go off of social media, they feel bad. They feel isolated. Social media is not bad, and I use social media, to be clear. But again, it's how many hours a day or how many minutes a day should you be on it? And as Ray Kurzweil says, your handheld device has access to all the world's knowledge at this point. Most of it's for free. What are you doing with it?
Right. That was exactly my point. And this library at your fingertips. So part two of the book gets into how to approach life then. And you you develop three imperatives: become self-aware, consider your lifetime, your lifespan and your time span the same thing, and learn a daily regime that, that heals and empowers you. I mean, did you do a lot of whittling to get down to just three of these?
Yes, I did. I enjoy doing that, though. I like Socratic logic. I like getting to the essence of things, distilling things down. And as I said, I've done a lot of study of comparative religions and philosophies and so on. And in the world we live in now, I think those are the three main imperatives. The first one is we have to begin some kind of self-study. I mean, people go to therapy. That's a good form of self-study. But there are many other forms as well. And in my book, I ask a series of questions that are designed to elicit further self-inquiry, further self-study. And it's amazing what people can come up with in 5 minutes. I do these seminars live and watch people as I ask a question. I say, okay, you have 3 minutes to answer it. And people will answer big questions such as, how do they define happiness? In 3 minutes. And they haven't been asked that in a long time. I received an email the other day from a woman who said, I'm the only person in her life that's ever asked her what makes her happy.
Really? Huh. Let us take a call. We have Will in Ashland on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Max Strom. His book is There Is No App for Happiness.
Thanks, Jeffrey. Hi, Max.
Hello.
Curious, you mentioned Viktor Frankl and his amazing work, A Man's Search for Meaning. What is your take on the best first response to extreme trauma? When something really horrendous occurs, you know, a person is not only not happy, they're traumatized.
That's right.
So in working with people over the years, I know there's a great variety of possibilities, but say a little bit about, you know, the first response to that kind of thing and how you begin to track your way back to happiness.
All right. Thanks for that, Will. Appreciate it.
I think I understood the question as what would I do if I were traumatized as opposed to what would I do if someone else near me was traumatized.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the way
I understood it too, yes.
Okay. Well, the first thing, the first go-to exercise that I use for any emotional disruption, whether I feel angry or grief or anything, is breath work. There are breathing exercises that can calm you down, that can lower your blood pressure and your heart rate and keep you feeling sane rather than going into panic or despair or rage. I think that's really the first thing because, you know, he was talking about trauma, which is pretty much an ultimate experience. And to be then with people that you trust the most in this world, to be in proximity, to be visited by your most trusted inner circle, I think is also the very next thing to do. And then, of course, therapy following. And there are many exercises for this. But breath work manages our emotions. And that's why it's taught to pregnant women who are going to give birth, because we know that certain breathing forms keep you from panicking, decrease physical pain, and help you to focus.
And I'm sure there are people who would probably say to you, well, what does that do? It doesn't change the situation. The answer is you're not trying to change the situation. You're trying to change your reaction to it.
That's exactly right. I mean, the firemen have their old sort of adage, their old joke that, you know, fire rages, people run screaming out of the building, and they go in the building. Everybody else is running out, and they're going in. Viktor Frankl used the example of the concentration camp scenario where he said, I saw German soldiers risking their life smuggling food in to save our lives, those that were sympathetic. And I saw fellow prisoners, adults, stealing food from small children, from toddlers, to save their own.
Wow, that's a major difference between those two groups. We'll talk more with Max Strom about his book, There Is No App for Happiness, How to Avoid a Near-Life Experience. We'll get further into some of his remedies for the world around us and how to make ourselves feel whole and complete within it. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Max Strom and your phone calls and emails in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Max Strom, yoga instructor, philosopher, writer, screenwriter, songwriter. He's done a lot in his life. He's written a second book now called There Is No App for Happiness, How to Avoid a Near-Life Experience, about the ways in which we make ourselves happy. And maybe it's not the exuberant happiness so often portrayed in television commercials, but a happiness that certainly you can live with. Max talks about how to get there. And you can join us on The Exchange at 800-838-3760. That's anywhere in our listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. Pam in Dexter, welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange.
Well, I used to say that the definition of success was happiness, because if you're happy, then you're doing the right things and balance in life. But lately, I've changed to kind of say a life of meaning and purpose and being fulfilled is probably more appropriate, because there is so much suffering in the world, and it's hard for me as a person who does research and a lot of environmental issues and kind of aware of what's going on in the world with a lot of suffering to really be happy, because I think if we're all connected, that we are connected to the suffering. And so I just wonder, how do you address the suffering of others? Because you just alluded to concentration camps, and I forgot the name of the movie where the man had his son in a concentration camp and kind of gave him this other world of reality of being happy, even though he was in the concentration camp. But that's pretty hard to overcome. And I just feel like there's a lot of suffering, and there's not a whole lot of hope on the path that we're on. So how do you feel, quote unquote, happy when you see all this suffering and you know that we're all connected? I mean, I believe we're all connected. And so I guess I'm wondering how you look at that. And I do feel like fulfillment and feeling like your life has meaning and purpose is probably more rewarding in the long run than just being quote-unquote happy.
All right. Mm-hmm.
And I'll listen on the radio. Thanks.
Thanks, Pam.
Thank you, Pam. That's an excellent point and question. We discuss through social media how connected we are, but if we are that connected, are we connected at the heart level or only on the social level? Do we care what happens to others? Do we help during times of emergency? That's an interesting, very interesting point. I believe, too, that we are all connected. And I think to answer your question most simply, it's nice to boil things down to, what if someone in your life that you really love is suffering? And empathy is extremely important aspect of being a human being. Being able to put yourself in someone else's shoes. Imagine what it would be like, for example, if my friend lost a child. I haven't lost a child, but can I imagine and feel something of what that would feel like? And therefore, I have sympathy as well as empathy and compassion and wish to help. If someone is suffering, my friend is suffering, if I then mirror his suffering, or her suffering, and I become equally upset and full of despair, I cannot really serve him or her. If I can maintain a peaceful heart amidst this crisis, I can be of much greater service. Just like the mother, when there's an emergency, if the mother panics, the children will panic. If the mother calms herself, the children will calm. So we can be of far greater service if we are peaceful in our heart and we are strong and we do not panic or mirror their grief or their anger. We stay centered. It's really a form of leadership.
Again, the second part of the book, There Is No App for Happiness, is about how to approach life. And there you give the three imperatives: one, to become self-aware; two, to consider your life and your time span the same thing; three, to learn a daily regime that heals and empowers. So on self-awareness, you have an exercise called the Book of Your Life. What is that exercise?
10 questions. And again, I do this in seminars, but I put the entire seminar pretty much into this book, where you're asked 10 key questions that reveal you to yourself. And you answer them quickly so that you don't over-intellectualize the answers. You know, for example, what's your code of ethics? Who are your true friends? And there are different questions that identify what objects are even important to you. What's your mission in life? All of these things. And again, we may have asked ourselves these questions at different times of our life, maybe once or twice, but generally we don't come back to them on a regular basis. Yet our definition of happiness continues to change regardless. For example, Jeff, you and I, probably being a pirate isn't as important now as it was when we were five.
Right.
You know, into a woman perhaps being a princess or a pirate isn't as important now as it was when they were five. Having a great car isn't as important now as when we were 16. So our definition of happiness changes. What brings us meaning changes. So I think it's really critical to know, if someone asks you what are your ethics, that you can answer, that you know what they are, because you've considered them not just once in your life or twice, but regularly, because that makes up who we are. Please go ahead.
Well, there's the in the book, There Is No App for Happiness, since this list of 10 questions that composes the Book of Life is about self-awareness, when you get particularly to the final question, how do you sabotage yourself? Can you seek out help from this? Is it purely your own devices identifying what the issues are with your life? Or can you seek some input from people who know you well?
You certainly can seek input. And a great exercise, which is in my first book, A Life Worth Breathing, is a very old exercise that's been shown up around the world in different psychological regimes, where you seek the advice of your peers, people that you respect, maybe five people, and you meet with them one at a time on various days. And you used to say you take notes, but I think recording the conversation is even better. And you basically ask three questions. One is, what are my gifts? What am I doing well? And you never interrupt them. You just listen and nod and ask for more. And after hours of them praising you, then you ask, how do you see me sabotaging myself? Is there anything I'm not seeing? Do I have a blind side that's right there that's keeping me from my happiness? And the third, which I've added more lately, is asking your peers, what do you think my mission in life is? Because many times people who are around us for years and love us and respect us have a clearer idea on our impact on the world than we do of ourselves. This occurred with me. This is how I started teaching. It's because every single one of my peers saw me as a teacher, everyone except one person, and that was me.
Do you think you could have been as happy as you are now doing something else? Were you?
No, I certainly wasn't. I found that I was the only one that didn't really see clearly what my path was. And this is my way, that teaching is my way of serving. And so I get to go somewhere every week, about 45 cities a year, 10 countries a year, and serve and help people to become happier, or at least, as I said earlier, to have a deeper meaning in their life. And this is very moving to me and an extraordinary privilege.
One of the ways in which you talk about finding deeper meaning is the concept of cultivating intimacy. If you're not either practiced or good, how do you begin to cultivate intimacy?
Cultivating intimacy is really, I'm glad you asked that, especially at the end of this talk, because it's really the crux of going back to so why not use social media all the time. People say they want more intimacy. Almost everybody says they want it. Well, get off your devices. You have to be face-to-face with someone. Learn to make eye contact. Learn to listen. Try to be empathetic to what they are saying. Speak the truth as opposed to around the truth. You know, be authentic as you possibly can. And I think one of the biggest issues in the American society in terms of where we blow it with intimacy is the subject of grief. Grief seems to scare us to death. It's like if you want to lose friends, say you're going through grief or you have cancer, and they'll stop calling you. Only a few friends will continue to reach out to you. Grief, though, could be and should be a bridge to other people. When you go through deep grief, you discover very quickly the fabric of your different relationships. Who can you rely on in times like this? And your intimacy grows deeper with those people. And the people that avoid you, you realize, well, they're great friends when things are going well, but I can't count on them in times like this. Whereas I think we're afraid of grief because we've been taught to be afraid of it. We've been taught to suppress it, push it down, be a man, get on with it. And suppressing grief is really rational in an emergency or in a war. But in peacetime, it's irrational. And it doesn't take much to connect with people when they're in grief. You don't have to have wise words. You don't have to be a sage. All you have to do is look at them in the eye and connect with them and allow them to tell you what they're thinking and what they're feeling. That's it. Be with them. Don't be afraid. Help a little bit. Bring some food over. That's it. And that builds such strong friendships, and we are missing the boat in this society on grief.
Which suggests that perhaps one of the things that is missing in our dependence upon apps and social media is that the key to intimacy is not so much putting yourself out there as letting other people put themselves out in front of you.
That's right. Being the witness. Being a good friend. Yeah, that's well said.
So the second of the three imperatives that you list here, consider your lifespan and your time as the same thing, or your life and your time span as the same thing. One of the things that you suggest in here is to schedule in time for which you have no plans.
Yes.
An interesting concept. You're probably alien in today's
it's
world.
It's kind of a Zen koan, isn't it?
Right.
Well, most of us have such a highly scheduled life, I think we need to do it. We need to learn to plan to say, you know, on the weekend, on Saturday, I'm not going to have any plans whatsoever. I'm going to allow spontaneity in my life. Yeah. I'm going to maybe have a Sabbath of not using electronic devices. You know, time to have repose, which is a word that's becoming archaic. I think maybe has become archaic. Of time of not sleeping, not necessarily drinking alcohol, but just hanging out with people that you really love and having a very nice time with them, or spending really quality time alone.
So in other words, just really plan to not really do anything. You can leave yourself some holes in your schedule. You don't have to be rushing off to the next thing all the time.
Yes. We're forgetting quickly, despite all the self-help books from the 90s and the 80s, that we are, as many writers have said, not human doers, we're human beings. And we need to remember to allow time to be and not constantly to do.
Max, in the third section about learning and practicing a daily regime that heals, empowers, and illuminates, you obviously practice and teach yoga. You've already talked about the connection between the body and the mind, the body and emotions. But there's a great question in here that you ask. Why stretching?
Because of our noisy, chaotic, intense, and overscheduled lives, most of us are living in fight or flight. That means our nervous system has been triggered for fight or flight, and it releases certain types of hormones and unfortunately suppresses our immune system, suppresses our digestive system and causes all kinds of havoc with us. And this is where the sleep disorder comes from primarily. So when we work out, whether it's running or tennis or weightlifting, still we're doing fight or flight type activities. When you stretch muscles, you trigger not flight or flight, but to switch over to rest and digest. In other words, from the sympathetic nervous system to the parasympathetic nervous system. And so stretching affects our nervous system in a healing way, and therefore affects the digestive system, our immune system, etc. So it's not only do you get all the benefits of stretching, of range of motion, grace, etc., but you trigger the nervous system and help to heal it in this way, which is critical.
Is it not enough to run or ride a bike or a salsa dance or something other physical?
No, it isn't. It isn't. And just ask any 50-year-old, because we call it getting older, but it isn't. If you just play tennis, at some point you're going to say, I have a shoulder issue and I have a lower back issue. If you play basketball, by the time you hit 40 or 50, now you're going to have knee issues. If you're a runner, you're probably going to have knee issues and lower back issues. If you're a bicyclist, you're going to have lower back issues because you're not including stretching.
Max, just a few seconds left for a final question. And when you talk about the practice of mental stillness, just how hard is it for most of us to shut our minds off for even a moment?
It's really hard, and that's why so many people give up meditation after a few tries, because they just feel like they're sitting in the naughty circle being told to be quiet for 5 minutes.
A lot of observations like that in the book. It is called There Is No App for Happiness, How to Avoid a Near-Life Experience. Max Strom, our guest here on the Jefferson Exchange. Max, thanks for joining us once again.
My pleasure, Jeffrey. Thank you.
It's good to have you here. That will do it for today's Jefferson Exchange. The Takeaway is next on the air if you're listening in the morning. If you're listening in the evening, and the rebroadcast will be followed by news from the BBC. Our producer is Charlotte Duren. Our student assistant is Reed Newland. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening, and please have a great day.